Hi, this is Dr. Pedro Ramirez, Editor-in-Chief of the International Journal of Gynecological Cancer, and today I have the great pleasure of speaking with my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Honey Marcus, who is in the Department of Neurosurgery at the National Hospital of Neurology and Neurosurgery in London. The reason for this podcast is our recent publication in Nature Medicine titled The Ideal Framework for Surgical Robotics, Development, Comparative Evaluation, and Long-Term Monitoring. Honey, welcome so much. Thank you for the acceptance of this podcast, and we're really looking forward to speaking with you.
Thank you so much, Pedro, for the kind invitation to talk to you today. It's a real pleasure.
Absolutely. Well, I should say that certainly I am a collaborator in this project, but certainly this is a project that under your leadership really led to a really outstanding manuscript. And we'd like to just have a discussion with you about some of the highlights of this manuscript. So, but I wanted to start by discussing as to what is the ideal framework?
Well, I think I would start by drawing a comparison to medications. And in the drug industry, it's very well established that there are distinct phases through which a new drug must go through before it becomes widely adopted. So you start with a phase one study, a first in human, and you proceed until you ultimately have a definitive, you know, multi-center RCT, a phase three study, and then long-term monitoring phase four. And for a long time, there's been nothing analogous in surgery. And there are lots of reasons for that, but one of the reasons is that surgery is inherently, I think, a much more complex intervention. Regardless of who prescribes the drug, if the drug is prescribed correctly, the patient gets the medication and it works. In surgery, we all know as surgeons that the same operation done by different surgeons may have very different outcomes. The technique is very user dependent. And beyond that, even the same surgeon on different days might have different outcomes, whether they're on form or not. And so tackling that complexity, the black box of surgery, has meant that clinical trials in surgery have lagged, I think, for some time, a long way away from where they are in medicine. That's changed with the ideal framework, which introduces several insights to try and overcome that barrier by explicitly thinking about things like learning curves and measuring them and looking at different types of trials that might allow for increased use within surgery. So that's what the ideal framework is about. It's an antidote to that sort of black box.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that for many, they may not be as familiar. So this is a really great opportunity to have these discussions. I wanted to ask specifically about this initiative. What was the incentive behind this project? What is the ideal robotics colloquium?
So thanks for that, Pedro. And I think the motivation was twofold. The first is that surgery, as we've just discussed, is really complex. But robotic surgery is even more complex because in addition to having an operation that is surgeon or user dependent, you have this extra entity, the robot, which is very large, costly, complex, affects not just the surgeon, but the healthcare institution. There's all these dynamics about training staff around it and maintaining the robot, its impact on the environment. And different types of robots may impact the nature of the surgery completely. It may be possible to do surgeries that are just not possible without the robot. So this increasingly complex robot is probably beyond not just contemporary evidence-based medicine, but even the ideal framework that was initially described. And so that was the first motivation. The second motivation is that for decades, the robotic industry has been dominated by a few companies. Am I allowed to talk about drug name? I don't know if I'm allowed to say the name, but I think everyone on the call would know which particular.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, well, Da Vinci then, by Intuitive, would be the big one. But that's actually changed in recent years. So a lot of their patents have expired over the last few years. There's been a huge explosion of robots as a result to try and compete in that niche. And not just like for like. Some are very similar to the Da Vinci, but many are completely different. Not just tackling the same procedures, but many new procedures. Mm-hmm. So I think over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a very different type of climate for robots, where they are not just sort of specifically used in niche cases, but loads of robots used for many different cases across all of surgery. And so I think the timing to have a framework before this explosion of robots ends up on the scene is perfect.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I'm glad you highlight that. Certainly this is applicable to multiple variations of different robotic systems in addition to what we currently use and what we currently know. Now, when you talked about the ideal stages of surgical evaluation, can you provide us with sort of like an overview of the current robotic systems across the ideal stages of evaluation?
I knew when you sent the list of questions that I might get that. And I was slightly anxious about it because there are so many robotic systems that it might consume a full hour talking about them all, well over 80 when we looked for this paper. But just to flag a few that I think are particularly important. At one end of the spectrum, at the very earliest stages, you have the first in human studies by the Maestro system, which is part of Boone Surgical. And that's at stage one. So a small first in human study with a handful of patients. Progressing, you have the Venice robot by Johnson and Johnson, which is used for arthroplasties. That's at stage 2A. So they've done a smaller single cohort study with, I can't remember the numbers, but I think 20, 30 patients, something like that. That's a stage 2A study. You have the Virtue system by Cambridge Medical Robotics, which is stage 2B. So extending beyond a single site to several sites with much larger numbers, prospectively. For stage three, a good example would be the Mako robotic system by Stryker, which is used in arthroplasties, and the Da Vinci robot Intuitive, which is sometimes stage three and sometimes stage four. In some indications, it's been used for a very long time, so I think it's in long-term monitoring, but in others, it's really much earlier on in its evaluation. And that highlights an important point, I think, Pedro, which is that the same robotic platform for different indications may be in different points of this pathway.
Yeah, absolutely. And honey, I'd like to get to some of the questions from our fellows in the journal. And this question is from Yossi Sewer from Montreal in Canada. And he's asking, in your experience, have robotic companies generally embraced or resisted the adoption of the ideal framework? Is there resistance? What specific obstacles have you observed?
Yeah, it's a very good question. The truth is that the response from robotics companies has been somewhat varied. Some of those, as you might imagine, have embraced it. I think that's particularly true for the new robotic companies on the scene. Some of the more established companies, I don't feel think they need it because they already have a robot that's been widely disseminated. The hope is that over time, the newer robots end up being established and are established in using the robotic framework that we proposed.
Yeah. Sabrina Piamonti, also from Montreal, she's asking, what are the examples of artificial intelligence platform under investigation that aim to automate certain surgical procedures?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent question, but it's the answer, the true full answer would take again a very long time because the AI is essentially being used in every single part of the surgical procedure, from assisting the way surgeons see tissue, so enhancing computer vision, to assisting the way they perform the procedure. So as Sabrina suggested, through automating parts of the procedure. And there are some authors, including Alan Kuntz, who was on this paper, who have done a lot of work on automating things like suturing and anastomosis, which is actually very hard to do because you have to both see and move correctly in order to do a complex maneuver like that. But I think this is a bit of a, let me think about the best way to describe this. I think the first instance, the better focus would be on AI-assisted surgery rather than AI surgery, at least in the foreseeable future. I think the first uses of AI are going to just be decision support for surgeons. And every study that I've seen, including many by my research group, has demonstrated really clearly that AI plus surgeon is better than AI or surgeon alone. So I can't see any value in replacing a surgeon with AI, not just from a ethical, medical, legal point of view, but also from a purely practical, pragmatic, what is the most effective intervention? It is more effective if you have two entities, the patient, the clinician and the AI working together. So I would pivot and say, yep, there's been some good work on automation, but actually the point really is AI supported surgery. And to give you an example of how that might pan out, we already have very good surgical AI systems in the lab. I have several we do up in our own lab, but that's true for lots of groups around the world, which can look at a surgical scene, identify the instruments, identify the step of the operation, identify the relevant anatomy. And again, we demonstrated that for each of those things, if you have AI supporting a senior clinician, even the senior clinician makes better decisions. They can recognize things they couldn't otherwise recognize or think about a step that they wouldn't normally consider. And they may decide that they don't want to do that or that they disagree, but the information is useful in improving the quality of the operation.
Excellent. So you did mention in this most recent answer the word medical legal, and I think this is somewhat fitting with the next question from Ilaria Capasso. And she mentions in this consensus, you've included non-medical professionals such as philosophers in your discussion. Have you perhaps discussed the legal and ethical implications of surgical robotics? As mentioned, artificial intelligence has the intrinsic ability to improve its skills and knowledge through practice and input, potentially surpassing human surgical skills. If a complication occurs in an integrated surgical robotic system with artificial intelligence, how do we deal with the legal and ethical responsibilities of this in the future?
Again, an excellent question. It is something we touch on in the framework. So for those listening, I would encourage you to read the framework for the full answer. The first thing to do is to recognize it as an issue and to suggest that the stakeholders involved with this think about it in advance. But again, circling back to the last question, I think this has been somewhat overstated, if I'm being candid, in the literature, because I don't see in the short to medium term procedures being autonomous. It's going to be performed with a clinician in the room. And again, that's partly because I think the procedures will be better performed with two people involved, the clinician and the AI support, but also because I think patient acceptability is far greater for a clinician being in the loop. And to touch on a legal point of view, the legal framework for an autonomous operation will always have the surgeon or clinician in the room carrying the can, and therefore the clinician will want to be close enough that they could stop something wrong happening. Now, there is a concept analogous to this in automated cars called a moral crumple zone. And for those of you that aren't familiar with this, it's a really good explanation for what we anecdotally feel, which is if you have someone driving a car, which is basically driving itself, and the car, which is automated, makes an error, we humans will naturally ascribe the problem to the driver rather than the software. We naturally assume that the human in the loop has the ultimate responsibility. And I think it's going to be that way for a long time, both ethically and legally. And so I think that's going to be most true, even after it's accepted in other parts of our day-to-day life. It'll be most true for clinical practice and surgery, which is a very intimate and high-risk event in anyone's life. So I think long after AI in cars be fully automated and that AI takes responsibility, it'll be decades after that the same will be true for a surgeon. So I think for you and me, Pedro, I think we'll ultimately be responsible, even if we're standing back and watching the AI do some of it.
Very well. So, honey, this question from Diletta Fugamali is pertaining to, are we really measuring the right metrics when we're evaluating and integrating robotics in surgery? She mentions in the key recommendations for ideal stages 0 to 2A, it is stated that a clinical outcomes-based approach should be used as the primary focus of assessment when evaluating the performance of robotics. Do you think that the traditional outcome metrics, such as complication rates, recurrence rates, blood loss, are sufficient to evaluate clinical usefulness of robotics?
Thank you. The answer is that they are necessary but not sufficient. So I do think that they form part of the framework. You have to evaluate those things. They're very basic outcomes as a surgeon that we're all interested in. But if you only look at that outcomes through those lens of things like effectiveness and resection, progression-free survival, you miss other very important points of view. And so a very useful way of thinking about this problem is through the different stakeholders. And yes, you have a device that is safe and effective, but the other questions are, do patients find it acceptable? You know, is it usable by clinicians? You know, what are the learning curves and how easy is it to teach people to use it? And more widely, is it economically feasible? Is it sustainable? Is it going to cause a huge impact on the environment? These are all things to consider. So I think I would thoroughly recommend that in evaluating a new robot, every stakeholder perspective is thought about.
Yeah. And Elena Oliaro asked a slightly different question with regards to how do we evaluate complications and in the management of surgical complications, how would you imagine new robotics, particularly robotics with artificial intelligence, to really be helpful in hopefully decreasing those complications?
Yeah, it's a question similar to some of those earlier that we've discussed on the role of AI in surgery. The most basic advantage of AI is numbers. It's a pure numbers game. Even if you're the best surgeon, you only have your lifetime to operate. So you learn from the cases that you do, and maybe some cases that you read about. But fundamentally, I mean, for my operations, for example, pituitary surgery, if you do, I don't know, 5 or 10 a week, you could amass 2,000 in a lifetime in a clinical career. And we have AI platforms that we've developed in-house that already have many, many hundreds of cases, you know, more than an average surgeon could amass in a lifetime. So it's very easy to imagine a situation just in a few years where AI could take advantage of more videos, more operations than any surgeon has ever amassed or could ever amass. It would just be orders of magnitude greater than any of us could manage. And so if it's able to take advantage of that experience, and I really think it could make operations safer and more effective. But I do think that the way in which it will do that is very much like having an adjunct and very much like having a senior surgeon next to you, just sort of suggesting things. And we all have experience of this as trainees, as residents, where we have a consultant or staff surgeon next to us while you're operating. Maybe at the end of your career, when you're not, you know, when they're not scrubbed, but just watching you at the corner of the room. And they'll mostly be quiet, but every now and then they might, you know, suggest something. And I think the way that we've used this in the lab has been very analogous to that, in that if you're a very good surgeon, you might not need very much AI assistance, but every now and then, whether it's for complex cases or something where perhaps you just miss it, the AI might provide a suggestion which you may accept or you may ignore. And the better AI is, the more likely it is, I think, that we will trust it to make some good calls and listen to it. Interestingly, when we've looked at this in our own data, Pedro, we found two really interesting findings, really, really interesting findings. This is very hot off the press, but I think has been found in other contexts too. The first is that very convincingly, and I've touched on this already, every stage of surgeon benefits from having AI assistants. That is true for juniors and also true for very senior and experienced surgeons. And in some cases, the most experienced surgeons gain the most. So the jump in performance is biggest for the most experienced surgeons. And this idea, we think, is due to, you know, with an experienced surgeon, the eye sees what the mind knows. You know, if you have a suggestion that this might be a blood vessel, and your experience, you go, aha, yes, that is a blood vessel. I can see it now. The contours make sense. And if you're inexperienced, you might ignore it because you don't see what the computer's saying. And the second thing to mention is that the biggest issue where that's not true has been the trust of surgeons and AI, and this relates to some other stuff we've done within the ITIL framework, which is that even if the AI is saying the right thing, if the interface isn't correct, if the surgeon doesn't trust it and just ignores it, then you don't see those corresponding improvements in performance. And so the corollary to my mind is that actually the AI could be super helpful whatever stage you're at, but the focus actually needs to be very much in this interaction between the AI and the clinician. It's not going to be working in isolation. It won't be doing the operation without us as surgeons. So the real research and the real focus in both developing and evaluating AI has to be on this interface between clinicians and AI, how to allow the AI to work better with us, and how to ensure that clinicians are believing it when it tells us something that we need to know.
Really great. And now, honey, one of the things that, and we actually have it as part of the title, long-term monitoring. This next question comes from Sabrina Piemonte again. And she's asking, certainly robotic platforms, particularly in the field of gynecologic oncology, have been used for 10, 15 years with objectively improved patient outcomes and some cost-effectiveness analyses. However, seldom are we seeing audits or quality reviews of standard practice. How should this be actually integrated as part of the introduction of new robotics technology? And particularly, how do we continue to assure that there is that long-term monitoring?
Well, I think it starts with podcasts like this, Pedro. Just need to get the word out. I think, in truth, this has got to be something that we try to disseminate by all the means that we can. We were lucky to have this published in a good journal, so that's a good start. Pedro, you know as well as I do that this is the very beginning of this process. We have to disseminate in through editorials, through implementing and practice, through supporting regulators and picking this up with their own frameworks. And I think most importantly, to talk to colleagues about it. We all are involved with research, even if we don't have some academic title, because if you adopt any technique or instrument, you're relying on this body of evidence that someone else has done, even if you're not contributing it. And so therefore, even if you're picking up this evidence without being actively involved in developing evidence, you have to have at least a critical eye for understanding what it is that someone else has done, whether it cuts the mustard. And I think that's a really important role. So I have lots of colleagues who aren't involved with research, and some of them are very good at this, because if you're a surgeon and you've just been given an instrument by some device developer and they say use it, and something bad happens, you may not be responsible legally, but you're definitely responsible ethically and morally. And so I would say very strongly that everyone who uses robots should read the framework, so they have in their own mind a judgment as to whether or not there is sufficient evidence for them to be doing so. And if not, then they should create the evidence.
And honey, this next question is, I think that we would all agree that, certainly these are all points that clinicians, surgeons would agree with. But the question is, what steps should we be taking to be much more proactive in fostering a wider implementation of these principles in the robotic industry?
Thanks, Pedro. I wonder whether the best way to do so would be to, again, to consider the various stakeholders. So we talked a lot about sort of surgeons being aware of this, disseminating it through podcasts and journal articles and through mouth, by word by mouth. But the other stakeholders are the patients, and there are lots of patient groups that were involved in creating these robotic guidelines. They feel very strongly about the role of patients in that decision making, that it should be shared. The role of hospitals. I think robots are incredibly impactful for hospitals. They're hugely costly, expensive inlays for hospitals, and they can really benefit the hospital as well as the patients and the surgeons. But that comes at a risk. So I think hospitals should be invested in this, and there are people again involved with this framework, Pedro, who, as you know, are involved with making the decisions in hospitals. So I think they should be involved as stakeholders. And then lastly, as it's been touched on, the journals and the regulators themselves, the journals not just to disseminate the frameworks, but also to draw a line in the sand and say, if you're publishing on things like robotics, we really want you to think about these frameworks, whether or not you adopt it line by line, but to think about these frameworks and these stakeholders to do the research better. To do better quality research for better quality evidence to make better quality decisions. The last stakeholder group, I suppose, is regulators. I think that's the toughest nut to crack, but we've already had some discussions with some regulators about this sort of thing. And I'm very hopeful whether actively or passively, that things will shift this way over the next few years.
So now, Henny, a question that we knew would come up, of course, obviously, disparities. When integrating robotic surgery, how can we reduce these disparities as it pertains to geography, economics? Certainly for many in low-income countries, this is really not very relevant in terms of the fact that they will very low likelihood have a very low likelihood of acquiring many of these innovative robotic systems.
I would like to answer that question by beginning with a history of computing. So everyone listening will know that computers, when they were first described, were mainframes that filled a room, very costly, very expensive. And now most of us, you showed you have two of them, in fact, Pedro, a moment ago, have two smartphones on them, each of which would be a supercomputer, even by fairly recent standards with their processing power. But you don't consider a computer, you just consider a phone and maybe an internet browser. And I think the same will be true for robots. The current robot designs are just that. They're the current robot designs. They are not the way robotics is going to be forever. They can't be. And I think with some creativity, there's lots of alternatives that may be much better suited, in fact, to being disseminated and to reducing inequality, with less of a footprint, less costly, less complex. And so I think actually, in the future, you'll see robotics, and it's going to seem unusual to say this, but disappearing in the background a bit. You'll be using robots and not call them robots. You'll just say, I'm going to use this articulated lap instrument. You won't have to bring in something, it will just be part of the operation. You will use a specific instrument that has robotic qualities. And so that would be my pitch for, I think, what will happen over the next few years. And we're seeing this a little bit already with new robotic designs emerging, handheld, ungrounded robots. And even if it's not the case that those end up making a big impact, I think the fact that they exist will push everyone else to up their game.
Very well. Honey, this question from Bella Giugelli in Georgia. She asks, do you think that increasing use of robotics, technology, and innovation will decrease the traditional surgical approaches of either standard laparoscopy or open surgery?
Yeah, I have to say I respectfully disagree. I think the opposite might happen. If you think about keyhole surgery, the general public perception is that with a surgeon doing keyhole surgery, they are a much better surgeon than a surgeon doing open surgery. I think that's true, by the way. But it is technically sometimes more difficult. It's more fiddly. And I think that probably that would be the case with the robotic surgery, that people already assume, and this I don't think is true, but I think people will assume that robotic surgery is an even bigger deal. Surgeon to robotic surgery is even better than a surgeon not doing robotic surgery. I have to say that I think it's the answer. The real truth is that I don't think a robotic surgeon is better intrinsically than a non-robotic surgeon. But just like we talked about with AI, I think a surgeon with help can do better than a surgeon without help, whatever that help is, whether it's by robotics or AI or a combination of the two. I would also say that, whatever they think, we need to prove it. Your work in this area, Pedro, is exemplary. There were cases where this implicit assumption that robotics or AI or technology is better is absolutely not always the case. There are cases where it's the opposite is true. And so I think that the public perception will be that it enhances surgical skills and that surgeons have better skills with robots, but I think we as surgeons have a duty to prove it.
Excellent. So now, this question from Arthur Hsu in Taiwan, and he talks about how robotic surgery obviously could be beneficial to patients, but regardless of where you are, it is a costly technology. In Ideal Stage 4, you state one of the key challenges is, quote, consider the benefits of robots against the wider health system needs and rationally allocate limited resources to high priority issues. How do you ensure this will happen?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we do stay in stage four, but we also stay in stage zero and one. And that, I think, is where the greatest impact will be felt because there are going to be robot designs that are not big telesurgical platforms, and are actually designed from the beginning with this idea that they can be used in lower and middle income countries. And those robots, I think, have a much better chance of making it to wide dissemination worldwide. In the meantime, it's the sort of plan B, if you like, is to do what we can with the robots that are presently available. And I think for those robots, you have to make some tough decisions. And the best way to make those decisions about whether you buy a robot and what you use it for is to first have evidence, which is very often lacking. So I think having evidence to say in this particular procedure, a robot is extremely beneficial, is a good driver to get the robot. The absence of evidence isn't an absence, evidence of absence, but it does make it much harder to justify this very costly outlay of a robot system if you don't have the evidence behind you. That's what I would say. I would say that the best argument is to start at the very beginning, to have new robots that are better suited for low middle income countries. But if you don't, then the next best thing is to have very good evidence to prove that it's really worth it.
Great. And I just have two more questions. And the first one of those is, what do you think are the most relevant unmet needs in developing new robotic devices?
The most relevant unmet needs. I think you've actually already flagged this in previous questions, which is creating devices that allow for reduced inequality and increased sustainability. So of those metrics that I said at the very beginning, the device perspective, devices being safe and effective, that is the one that people always think of. The evidence of robotics is a little bit limited, but the evidence that exists is mainly around this. Is it safe? Is it effective? But that's not the end of the picture. Usability and patient acceptability are also really important. A robot that is safe and effective, but no one can use or no patients accept, will not do very well. But the stakeholder perspective that no one ever really thinks hard enough about is exactly this, the system perspective. Is the robot just economically feasible? Is it going to have a huge impact to sustainability? If you buy this robot, you're going to need people around it. You're going to be able to make it work. And so I think the biggest unmet need relates to addressing that system perspective.
Excellent. And as a last question, if you could share with our audience as to what do you see as the really exciting and future ongoing projects for the IDEAL framework?
Well, I think considering that the IDEAL framework is all about complex interventions, the next couple of things that I think still warrant addressing are global surgery, IDEAL in global surgery, which, as I've touched on a few times now, I think is very important, but also IDEAL surgical education. Education is a really complex intervention, just like surgery is. It's very user dependent. If a good teacher says something, the delivery of the teaching, if you like, will be much better than a bad teacher saying the same thing or using the same teaching style. So, yeah. And for the same reason, therefore, people have considered a black box and assumed that there's no way of evaluating teaching. It's too complicated. That's not true. And I think IDEAL also has something to say about the way surgical education is delivered, whether that's biotechnologies, adjuncts, things like tele-mentoring and simulations, or whether that's much more widespread, things like simulation. But I think IDEAL has something to say about that. So I think that would be the projects that we're focusing on next. For those of you that want to be involved with those things, I would strongly recommend coming along to the IDEAL meeting in 2024. So that's being held in April here in London. And that's on the 3rd and 4th of April, so the Wednesday and Thursday. As I said just before this podcast, London is the best city in the world, but I am somewhat biased. And so if you've not been to London, I would use it as an excuse to come. And when you come, you'll be pleasantly surprised because the conference itself is brilliant. Also, I'm biased.
Thank you very much, honey, for that plug to the IDEAL conference, and I will definitely be there. I really wanted to thank you so much for not just obviously sharing your time and discussing these questions, but also for your leadership within the IDEAL framework. Really always enjoyed working with you very much and learn a great deal from you every time we discuss these very important topics. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you once again for having me. It's been great.